TCL is a proud sponsor of the Score North Studios. TCL, America's fastest growing TV brand. It's Raised by Wolves.
Sure is Raised by Wolves. Manny Hill, Dane Moore is here. Danny Cunningham, as usual. All three of us in the brand spanking new podcast studio.
How long do we get to call it that? How long is it brand new for?
I just listened to your last podcast, and that is how you led the last podcast.
Exactly. How long can we drag? I mean, I'm okay with it today. Like, it's day number two. But how long can we drag this out?
I'm going to milk it for as long as I can.
Like, is it going to be 2021 year, but in the brand new studio?
Probably won't go that far, no.
I can co-sign that it's very nice. This is my first time here.
Yeah, it's awesome here. Brand new, Dane, if you haven't heard.
Brand new podcast studio. So lots to get into with the Wolves, and Dane, let's start with you on just how things have gone since the last time you were on the pod last week for the Wolves.
That was Sunday. When I was in Philly, right? So
yeah,
basically, so you got the Philly game
before
San Antonio.
They got embarrassed.
Philly was rough.
It did not go well.
How was Philly for you?
It was fun for me. I mean, I hadn't been there before.
Did you have cheesesteak?
I didn't. You know, there was just
Dane.
I know. I had the media meal, and I don't know, like breakfast.
What was it? What was the media meal?
You know, I'll say it wasn't as good as the Timberwolves media
really?
Meals. I like the Timberwolves. Since, have you noticed that in the media room, they changed everything up?
Oh, things changed.
Right after Tibbs
left. I did not know that the president of basketball operations controlled the food. I was unaware that was part of his job responsibilities, but the media room changed.
I will say in Philly, if I'm trying to grab positives, it was cool to watch Philadelphia play and just in person and kind of be around that team. And the East is an interesting, you know, there's an interesting group at the top there, and Philadelphia deserves to be in that
group.
Conversation.
That top five's fun. I'm almost one to say the top six is fun. I can't like include the Nets in the same conversation
no,
as the
you
top
can't.
Five, but the Nets are so much fun. I love watching the Nets, and I have for like 3 years. They're so much fun to watch.
How about D'Lo dropping, what was it, 7
he's gonna
or 14
be an all-star.
From three last
He's
night?
Going to be an all-star.
That's
which
incredible.
Is crazy.
The
because...
East is not good, and that's why, but D'Angelo Russell is going to be an all-star, and the Lakers have Lonzo Ball instead.
And, I mean, so Cat will probably make the all-star team, but he's like a fringe guy, kind of, in the West.
Fringe. I think he's pretty safe.
Yeah, I think he's pretty safe, too, but it's kind of in one of those wild card spots, I think. How they set that up.
I think he's pretty safe.
But still, if D'Angelo Russell makes it versus Cat, who, I don't know, D'Lo's balling, but Cat is a whole different level player than D'Angelo Russell, or maybe like an Eric Bledsoe makes it in the East or something like that. I mean, it's not even close. It's just, I think that juxtaposition of the end of the East All-Stars and the end of the West All-Stars is a... It just shows you the disparity between the two conferences.
Oh, it's ridiculous. Like,
but Philly deserves credit. Like,
for sure.
That's Philly a dang good team.
Philly could potentially have four All-Stars just because of how bad the East is.
Right.
Like, Simmons and Embiid are absolutely deserving. I'm not 100% thinking that Jimmy Butler deserves to be an All-Star. Because I don't think that, and Zach Lowe has talked about this in his writing and on his podcast, The Lowe Post. If you sabotage a team the way he did the Wolves, I don't think that you should be, like, That doesn't make you an all-star.
You got to consider.
And it's not like he's lit the world on fire in Philly either. Like, he's been good, but he's not been like, oh, this dude's the best.
Right.
But J.J. Redick's had a really good year for them, too.
J.J. deserves credit. I mean, and Ben Simmons will, of course, make it, too. I mean,
yeah.
Him in person was wild. This funny story. I was in the locker room before the game started, and Ben Simmons was, like, looking for his shoes, or the trainer was going to grab him something, and he went and jumped on the scale, and he's like, oh, 250.
Wow.
Damn. I was like,
jeez.
250? That dude weighs 250 pounds and moves.
He's 6'10".
And that my thing is, and I have this like long-standing grudge against the measurements, like when you Google someone's height and weight on like Wikipedia or whatever, like their official listings, Ben Simmons is listed at 6'10", 230. He's 250. Like, he's definitely 250. I saw him get on a
definitely
scale.
Definitely 6'10", though.
So those are, I don't know. Weight, why, how do they just get to determine what they want their weight to be? They should need to be weighed
when
and measured.
They're a rookie. They basically go with their rookie measurements. Like, LeBron was listed at 6'8", 250 as a rookie, and that's been his That's been his measurement from year one until year 16. You think he's been the same thing every since he was 18?
What? Why
like,
is that
guys
okay?
Change. I think not, Wiggins, I'm not saying it is, but that's just how it goes.
Wiggins' listed weight, I think, is what, 194 or something like? 6'8", 194, and it's like he's
You think he's put on a lot of weight? He's maybe put on like 5.
He's got to be at least 200 pounds.
Yes, yes.
I think he's more than 194, though.
Yes. Like, you're not as tall as he is. And able to physically play this game, because you can say a lot of things about Wiggins negative, but he's always available. He's missed what, 5 games in his career now,
and this amount of time, his strength has improved.
Is an impressive thing to be that durable. You don't do that at 194.
No, that's true.
I'm sorry. I'm not saying he's much heavier than that, but he's at least 200 pounds.
I would say the single thing that's improved most about his defense over the course of his career. Is strength, specifically defending the post. Like, you see guys sometimes go into him and try and lower their shoulder right into his chest, and Wiggins doesn't give ground in the way that a typical 194-pound
player would. Because he's not 194 pounds.
That's probably what it is.
If he were 194 pounds, he wouldn't be as good.
That's true.
It seems like his rebounding numbers have gone up this year.
A little bit.
Too.
I mean, he's still not impressive.
We can't give him credit for rebounding. I mean, it still needs to be better.
And Manny and I talked about this a little bit yesterday. How much longer do we keep beating this Wiggins drum?
Yeah.
How much longer do we just keep going on, you know, is he a bust or can he improve? What's going to do it for him? How much more time does he get before we just kind of write him off?
No, like you said yesterday, there's something sinking in that feels a lot like apathy when it comes to Andrew Wiggins.
And like, I'm at the point where I just think people don't care anymore. I think people are just kind of like, whatever.
Yeah, there's just an acceptance of... It was a miss. But just the volatility of his game, too. And because it's been such a consistent thing that he goes up and down, obviously, the OKC game to something like Phoenix on Sunday, where it's like, how can that be the same person from an engagement and a... I mean, he's being defended by Paul George for that whole game against Oklahoma City, and he's getting buckets consistently. And
Paul George has played at an MVP level all year.
He's defensive player of the year in my book.
Sure. That's very fair to say. I'm not going to argue with you on that. He's playing like as a top 5 player this year. He's been awesome. And Wiggins gave him work.
And then you come out against Phoenix in a game where your team is clearly needed some sort of spark, and they just relied on Cat, and they just couldn't.
And San Antonio.
Yeah, right? And you need somebody to make that... To recognize that this team is coasting at some point in the game, and it just very rarely feels like Wiggins is the one who acknowledges that and does something about it. Obviously, against Phoenix, it was D. Rose who was like, all right, we need something more. Too many guys are disengaged tonight. And instead of Wiggins being the person who steps up and does it, he's too often the one who is... The one who's
watching.
Doing the coasting, right?
Yeah. He's the one with his hands in the air as Derrick Rose hits a shot.
Yeah,
Danny, we talked about it yesterday.
Brought
in a perfect
it up yesterday.
World,
yeah.
Everything Derrick Rose did in that second half, Wiggins does that. In a perfect world for the Wolves, Wiggins is the one that takes over that half. Wiggins is the one that hits that game winner. Wiggins is the hero of the night. But
like you said, at what point?
That.
But I don't know. For me, that's not even the expectation. Like, I agree with you. It'd be great if it was.
But that's in a perfect world. That's what it would have been.
Sure. But I'm glad that D. Rose took that shot at the end of the game.
Oh, yeah. There was no other option.
Right.
There was no way. You can't give Wiggins the ball there. Cat had a great first half, and I don't want to say disappeared, but the Suns really changed their defensive strategy toward him in the second half.
So I think that's interesting. Like, yes, you're right. Like, they're bringing doubles from a different direction, more so from the top side. But he was getting doubled in the first half, too. And he was just like, whatever, I got Dragan Bender on me. I'm going through this, and I'm looking for it and looking to score. I think the difference was in the second half is he's like, all right, D. Rose has it rolling a little bit. I'm going to be more willing to, you know, be more passive in this situation. Mm-hmm. And I think there are real questions about if that's the best thing or not for the team. Of course, in that instance, in that game, D. Rose gets 29. But
In the second half.
But... What if it's not the great Derrick Rose game? What if it's an average Rose game?
Well, at what point does he realize it's not?
But that's
the other key. You need him to realize that. And he, like you just said, he realized Derrick Rose had it going, so it made sense. I would hope if he can realize Derrick Rose has it going, that he could also realize when Derrick doesn't have it
going.
So
if Derrick gets off to like a 1-for-9
which he kind of did. He did not. He had 2 points in the first half.
How long do you stick with him and continue to sort of run the offense sort of through him?
I think an issue is there's almost a blind faith in Derrick Rose from a lot of those players. Again, it was warranted.
And a lot of people in the world in general.
Well, sure. But even Kat, like, I don't think Kat would be like, oh, Derrick Rose doesn't have it going. I mean, then that's going to prevent me from kicking it out to him and letting him isolate. Like, he's like, oh, there's Derrick Rose. I'm going to kick it to him. Like, there's a difference in Rose's perception versus what he consistently is. Mm-hmm. A lot of the times, it's been good. But I think for this team, it's critical to be able to distinguish when we just need this to continue to be Kat. I think that second half goes better if you continue to roll with Kat, just because that's a more effective option. Kat on Dragan Bender in the post, mm-hmm. rather than Derrick Rose isolating, simply because where Kat's going to be catching it and looking to score is going to be within, 8 feet of the hoop.
Hopefully.
Versus Rose, who, again, played great in that situation, but generally speaking, his two-point shots are much more difficult looks.
I think some of that in the second half was the Wolves couldn't get him the ball. I mean, there were more. Yeah. Jeff Teague didn't play a ton in that second half before he left with an illness. But when he was out there, he just couldn't get Kat the ball. Like, they really struggled to throw entry passes at time. Like, simple things in the NBA.
And that's not
that's
new,
been
right?
an issue for a while.
But to D-Rose's credit, that's what he's the best.
Yes.
He's the best at getting Kat the ball in the post and just being like, all right, there's Kat. He's being defended by Dragan Bender. We got to give him the ball. And there's been consistently, I think that's another thing you can hold Wiggins accountable for, is not looking to utilize Kat as much as he can. An example we've talked about before is a lot of the times in pick and roll situations, when it does happen, when Kat's setting a screen for Wiggins, Wiggins will reject the screen and go the opposite way of it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that works. I'm glad to see them running pick and roll situations, but there's a weird kind of, I don't know, with Wiggins, he's not consistently looking to involve Kat in the offensive situations that they're both involved in. And simply by, diverting to Kat a little bit more in those situations, it's going to be more effective because Kat is arguably the most effective offensive player in the entire league when he's getting the ball in his spots. And
sure.
I don't know. It's great news that Kat is having this type of offensive season, given the notion that I don't think he plays with players who optimize his skill sets.
Okay, let's do this exercise. What would your ideal starting five around Karl-Anthony Towns look like? A realistic ideal one.
So I'm actually writing about this for tomorrow, and I think we need to consider the idea of having another big alongside Kat, which Taj kind of is.
And Taj has been great this year. I just want to throw that out there. Taj has been awesome this season.
Absolutely. But then on the wing, I don't know. So mixing that in a little bit, where I think that more so helps the defense because it might clog the offense. But if you could have another big who also stretches the floor next to Kat, like a Marc Gasol or something like that, I think that'd be very ideal for the floor spacing around him. But then you also just need to have guys who, when Kat kicks it out and gets that hockey assist that swings over to Jeff Teague, that's got to be a knockdown shooter.
Well, you need Jeff Teague to shoot it.
Yeah, no, but
not just a knockdown shooter. You just need someone that's going to shoot.
And that would be one of the pieces. There are probably two pieces like that. A guy who's just ready to catch and shoot in those situations. And then I do think it is important to have an isolator like Derrick Rose.
Mm-hmm.
That, all right, Kat didn't get his look easy here. There's now 9-8 seconds left on the shot clock. Somebody who can create for themselves. So, in theory, you kind of have this on this team, but Wiggins and Teague just don't do it. Mm-hmm. They just don't do it. And I think that subtracts from the overall effectiveness of the offense.
I think too, when you look at that, it kind of raises a bigger question as it pertains to Andrew Wiggins, that if this is going to be who Andrew is, how can this team build around Karl-Anthony Towns with Andrew sort of still being here and the salary taking up as much of the cap as it is, and you're maybe not getting the kind of production you need out of Wiggins? How can this team sort of, despite that, still put together a good roster around Kat?
Well, I would say it's not only just about the salary cap that he uses, it's also the usage of possessions that Andrew Wiggins have that does use. If you could have Wiggins still out there, but in a lower usage role, and find a way through trades, free agency, to nail another offensive wing weapon, then that could work if you had Cat, Wiggins, and Wing X. But it only works if Wiggins lowers his usage.
Sure.
Because, again, it just, if this is the player that Wiggins is going to most consistently play as, it's a negative, it just has a negative effect on Cat.
Yeah, it absolutely does. There's no other way to say it, really.
And, I mean, I don't know, that, but the frustration is, who's that guy? Who, I mean, you're going to have the mid-level exception this year. Yeah, like, who are you going to get for, like, $9 million this, I don't know, this offseason that's able to provide that? That's the issue there.
You're going to have to catch lightning in a bottle. That's what it is. You're going to have to strike gold on somebody that maybe is, or, you know, buying low. That's kind of how you're going to have to be able to get good.
To get lucky.
Yeah. And that's what good, well, I mean, maybe it's
good
not
good organizations
luck.
Do that.
That's what I was going to say. It's like, you know, do your due diligence, effectively present that, hey, this is a role we have on our team here, Lou Williams. Like, you can be this guy. We want to readjust our offense in a way where, you know, we're going through Cat a lot. He's our guy, but we do need this player. Sign a 4-year, $36 million deal with us. Maybe it's not Lou Williams. He's 32, but
and
somebody
he's also
like that.
Under contract.
Yeah, that's true. But that type of player, you know what I'm saying? Somebody who can create, and you get them, you convince them to sign for the mid-level exception, which the Wolves have, rather than taking a little bit more to go somewhere else. But again, you need to have a good general manager there. You need to have a good coach that's able to present this and pitch that. And that is a factor, I think, in this season, as we look into next season, of, you know, who are you going to want to sign here when you don't know who the coach is, you don't know what the front office is, and it's kind of confusing what direction the team's going. Yes, Cat's attractive, and to some extent Wiggins is too, to players around the league. But if you're going to sign a 4-year deal to come play in Minnesota, you probably want some assurances, or at least an understanding of what things are going to look like. I mean, they really can't afford to use...
It would be so much more fun if the Wolves had money this offseason.
Right.
So much more fun.
Yeah.
Like, if they could even go after a guy like Chris Middleton, I think he'd be a really good fit alongside Cat.
But, that's like four levels higher than what I know you know that, their spending capital is right now. But
or a guy like Jimmy Butler.
Dan, you wrote about this today on the site, is the trade deadline. Mm-hmm. And, you know, The argument, I think, for moving some of these guys on expiring deals is that you do accumulate some assets that increase the possibility of someday being out and being able to go get that Chris Middleton or Wing X that we keep saying. And while it would be a devastating blow to the locker room and the leadership there now to lose D. Rose, to lose Gibson, even Tolliver, you know, to some extent, you do need to consider... Do we need those assets? Do we need two or three second-round picks that maybe we can turn into a first-round pick? Or can we do something to get a first-round pick that then in the future we can either nail that pick and get a Donovan Mitchell or move that pick to get a more established wing? That's the argument for moving on from some of these veterans at the deadline. Obviously, it's going to hurt them this season, but once you look forward to 2021,
you gotta think bigger
2022,
picture.
Like... Are those assets big enough? That's the question. Can you get enough for those guys that it's able to eventually move the needle down the road once Cat is definitively in his prime? And I don't know. I don't know what the market is for Taj Gibson. I don't know what the market is for Derrick Rose.
No.
He also has the veto power. And even Anthony Tolliver, too. It's like...
I think Anthony Tolliver is the easiest one to move.
I think so, too.
Because, one... You are not waving the white flag on your season by trading Anthony Tolliver.
Yep.
You're just not. If you trade Taj or if you trade Derrick Rose, your season, you are not competitive.
You can from a PR perspective, you know, explain spin that one. Right? Because it's like, well, we traded for Dario. We thought that AT was going to be the guy here.
Yep.
It just hasn't worked.
And I looked this up yesterday. Let me pull it back up, but Tolliver's shooting, when he's got to be, shooters need to be able to get consistent time for the most part, unless you are just can come off the bench ice cold and knock one down and call it a day.
I think what you had was 34%, right?
He's shot 34% from deep since the Jimmy Butler trade. He's been in and out of the lineup. Mm-hmm. He had, I believe, 15 DNP CDs and four more games where he played 3 minutes or less. So essentially just garbage time from the time that the trade happened until Tibbs was fired. And I know some injuries happened towards the end of Tibbs' tenure here, so that kind of reinserted him back in the lineup, and now he is in the lineup again. They're still dealing with injuries, but he hasn't been able to find it. Before the trade, he shot 41% from three.
Well, and last year he was second in the whole NBA, only behind Steph Curry in true shooting percentage.
And he's okay.
Mm-hmm. I mean, well, so the team I think of is Oklahoma City.
Steph's okay. That
who needs? Oh, Steph's okay.
He's all right.
AT's okay. All right.
Also, did you guys see Klay Thompson last night?
Yep. Hit his first 10 threes.
Unbelievable.
But okay, so humor me here. If you're Oklahoma City, I think Anthony Tolliver gives you another shot at the, they gave that money to Patrick Patterson a couple years ago to be Anthony Tolliver, and he just has not been that at all.
I think
all.
That'd be a really good fit for him.
If they can move Tolliver and some and get. Maybe I don't know exactly what the pieces you get back from them directly, but if you can find a way to make a move where you turn the Tolliver contract and an asset into something that is much younger than AT, something along those lines, that could be. I mean, I think if you're making a move and quote unquote selling at the deadline, what you get back would go a long way to also look like a buy.
Yeah,
nail a nice young player who's still developing, something like that. Maybe with the OKC, that's like Terrence Ferguson, something like that.
I don't think they would move him, though.
I don't think they would either. But that type of player around the league who's a guy who...
Yeah, and you could get a third team involved.
Yes, and that's why it's always hard to have a trade.
That's why the trade machine's so fun. I love ESPN's just go wild. Trade machine. Like, I'm just trying to formulate as many four-team deals as possible.
But the thing is, for me, what I want, would like to see them target... other than Anthony Davis, is a player on a rookie scale contract who just hasn't totally fit in with where they are. I mean, obviously Dennis Smith is a bigger name in that sort of way, but
that's
it just
a
didn't
weird
really,
situation too.
It just didn't really work. Like, they got Luka, and now that asset that Dennis Smith still is has become a little distressed, and you can maybe get them to sell a little bit lower. Mm-hmm. And that's the type of thing I'd like to see the Wolves buy.
Mm-hmm. Would you buy a distressed take a chance on, like, Frank Ilikina from New York?
He's
another one that he's on a rookie contract, and things haven't gone well for him there. Maybe a change of scenery could be something that could help him.
So what does that deal look like?
I mean, his contract, hang on.
No. I mean, like, what is the trade you offer? Like, I don't know that... You got to kind of make a trade with a team who wants an Anthony Tolliver or a Taj Gibson. Like, New York doesn't. New York has no need for.
I mean, it is the Knicks. They have no need, but the no desire thing, pump the brakes, baby.
But as you said before, that goes to kind of like the three-team deal sort of way.
The thing that kind of complicates it is the lack of a true definition of buyers and sellers this year.
Absolutely.
Because in the East, you've got four or five teams. I mean, Orlando hasn't made the playoffs in a really long time. They might not want to sell. They might want to try and see if they can... It's unlikely, but try and see if they can get their way into the eighth seed. But out West, you've got two teams that are out of it, and that's it. You've got 13 teams that realistically could make the playoffs.
And would at least want to try and linger around, even if they stand pat. Like,
That's why I think these next seven games or six games or whatever for the Wolves are going to determine if they're buyers or sellers.
It also suggests that choosing to be a seller is an opportunity this year for the Wolves, as hard as it would be to... Again, to take the PR hit of moving Derrick Rose, who's been
awesome and loved. And...
All that sort of stuff. You might be able to get a first for Derrick Rose this year.
Maybe,
I think in a normal season, like last year, so Tyreke Evans was pretty similar to Derrick Rose last year, where he was kind of like a six-man on a really cheap contract and was having an awesome year for the Grizzlies. Yet they weren't able to get a first-round pick for him. And I think that was a product of the market. Whereas they were offered 2 seconds and they didn't, Memphis decided not to make a move because they were holding out for a first. Maybe this year Derrick Rose is able to get you a first. Maybe
there's
a little
different kind of demand for him than last year.
I don't know. But that would, for me, I think that's the line that I would draw with D Rose is get a first.
You need a one for him.
Mm-hmm. It wouldn't.
I don't think it's worth it to trade for him for two twos or something like that.
I mean, in a vacuum, it's like, yes, you want to get those assets. I was just saying, but man, I mean, Danny, you know, those guys love Derek.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone in that locker room loves
Everyone
Derek.
Everyone in the league loves Derek.
Yeah, players.
It's not a thing that's just new to Minnesota here. Everyone across the NBA loves Derrick Rose. He's been beloved everywhere he's been.
I just really think it would deflate like a Karl Anthony Towns, who we know has developed a relationship with him and everyone. I mean, Josh Okogie loves Derrick. Like, and that stuff's matters too. I don't know how exactly you weigh that versus the assets of second round picks and this and that. Mm-hmm. That's for a general manager, not somebody here on a podcast.
Other conversation: who's making this decision for Minnesota?
Yeah,
we don't know how much power Scott Layden really has. We don't know if Scott Layden's going to be around next year. We don't know if he's trusted with the future of this franchise if they're going to be sellers.
And it seems like, yeah, it even if they're buying, mm-hmm. it would be really tough for a guy who we're not even sure on his mm-hmm. future with the team to just be like, make all these decisions to like buy to try and make the playoff. Now, maybe in the case of Scott Layden, if he's trying to keep his job, maybe he is trying to make moves to where he's buying to try and, because if he can pull off something and it helps them get to the playoffs, then that might increase his chances of keeping his job. But at the same time, if you're not sure about his future, do you want him making big decisions like that and buying on something that may change the course of the future of your franchise if he's not going to be a part of it?
I mean, you'd rather have a general manager in place who you know has the long-term interest of the franchise in mind. Still, you would like to optimistically think that the organization is wise enough to have the person who's making the decisions be, you know, dedicated to the product.
Yeah.
And I don't think they would have just kept Scott Layden on to, you know, save $1 million or whatever. Like,
you don't know that.
I don't know that, but I would like to think that the organization realizes that this is a critical time in roster construction of the Timberwolves. You need the person making those decisions to be mm-hmm. to nail those moves. And to Layden's credit, like, the last Butler trade seems to have gone well
so far,
and a couple other moves along the way. I mean, Josh Okogie, that's a good, you know, a good draft pick. Like,
but how much of that was Thibodeau?
And that's what we don't know. And
have you noticed Scott Layden more visibly lately?
Oh yeah, just walking
he's been
over
around, man. He before they fired Tibbs,
yeah, nothing.
I had seen Scott Layden like twice. I've seen him at every single game since.
I think the only time I had saw him was when he came up to the porch with me and Judd at the state fair. That was back in
like
August.
Ever.
That was like the first time. I think that was the last time I had, you know, before Tibbs got fired. That was the last time I had like publicly seen Scott
I've seen
Layden.
Him at every game since.
I mean, I think he's always at.
I'm sure he's
the
always
games.
At the games, but he's
making himself more visible.
He's making an effort to be seen.
Right.
Like I saw. So I don't know if you guys saw the story about those two, that Japanese couple mm-hmm. that came to the United States for their honeymoon.
Mm-hmm.
They attempted to go to 13 NBA games in 13 days. Brutal. Could not imagine doing that. But their last stop was Sunday night at Target Center. And Scott Layden took pictures with them. Like, Scott Layden never did that. I had not seen Scott Layden meet with anybody publicly. And he's at center court 90 minutes before the game taking pictures with this couple.
And you know what? Like, the general manager of any sports team doesn't need to be beloved, and it's not necessarily a public figure mm-hmm. like across like some, for some teams like the Daryl Morey's and whatever, they're very active on social media or whatever, doing interviews.
Daryl
all around
might even be the exception.
Yeah. Like it could be like Scott Layden can be a fine general manager to keep if he's just doing his job, like handling.
I don't know if they just might want to kind of wipe the slate clean.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense too. But provided right now, on going into February 7th, he is on the slate, and you would think he's the chief decision maker in making what could be a pretty pivotal move or moves mm-hmm. at the, you know, at the deadline.
Well, and just the decision to be a buyer or a seller is a big one.
Totally,
it's huge.
Or a Stan Patter.
I mean, and we're talking about Derrick Rose and Taj Gibson and Anthony Tolliver, who are those are smaller moves.
Yeah,
to be made.
It's not like they're trading Wiggins.
But that's the thing is, at some point, bigger moves could be considered at the deadline, or certainly this offseason. And
this offseason is massive.
Yeah, and
that's so huge.
And that could include Jeff Teague, Andrew Wiggins, whatever. I mean, there's an argument to be made that there needs to be a pretty big shakeup this offseason.
Sure.
And or there just needs to be some, you know, operating effectively on the margins to nail putting together. Everything is about Karl Anthony Towns and Andrew Wiggins at this point.
I think everything's just Cat.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. Everything's about Cat, and it's about putting the pieces around him so as to embolden Cat as a player. And the person who makes those decisions is Scott Layden, is the general manager, and that's why it is critical, and you do want to have faith that he can make the, because a big deal could happen this offseason. Who knows? Dario Saric only will have 1 year left on his deal. He seems like a piece of the core. Robert Covington could be tradable again. That's a good contract.
But also with Saric, it's not, he's got 1 year left on his deal, but he's still controllable because it'll be restricted.
Right. But at the same time, because you have Cat and because you have Wiggins on those max contracts, it's not like you can just say, sure, we'll give Dario Saric 480 mm-hmm. when he becomes a restricted free agent, then you're in the tax like indefinitely, and you don't have flexibility. And how comfortable are you with a core of Cat, Wiggins, Saric, Covington? Like that doesn't sound that bad, but is that getting you better than the sixth or seventh seed in the West anytime soon?
And me and Danny talked about yesterday about how there's a position that's specifically critical this offseason, just because we just don't know where, because there's four guys that play that position on this roster right now.
Point guard.
Any of those guys, Tyus is going to be a restricted free agent. He could end up playing elsewhere. Jeff Teague has the player option. Derrick Rose. Yeah, it's massive.
It's massive not only because those guys are all on something that resembles an expiring contract, but because you have no other creators on this team.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew Wiggins is not a distributing creator on this team. For the strengths of Josh Okogie and Robert Covington, and Ryan Saunders talked about this after the game on Friday, it is not their strength to do anything off of the dribble and to create for other players.
They don't have wings that can dribble.
No, they don't. I mean, at least at a high level.
Like dribble, period.
Yeah, okay. It makes the point guard position all that more important, because you need someone who can create. You need that when your best player can't do that because he's a center. You need to nail that position going forward. And again, to the general manager conversation, there's a lot of different ways you can go with that. You can say, maybe we bring back Tyus and another kind of bridge type point guard who they share the minutes like 25, 23, something like that.
Does it make you feel more inclined to bring Derek, to find a way to bring Derek back?
It's going to depend on money. He's earned himself a check this year. Now, I know he said a couple weeks ago that he would want to stay in Minnesota, which is obviously positive news for the team, but it wouldn't surprise me to see somebody, maybe Chicago, come with a big offer for him.
I do fall in the pro-Derek conversation side of the conversation, and I think he has been helpful.
Pro him as a player or pro keeping him?
Pro him as a player, that he's been a positive.
I agree.
100%. But a lot of there are arguments to that he hasn't been. Mm-hmm. The defense has unilaterally been worse with Rose on the floor, and there's an argument to be made that some of his offense cannibalizes some of the other offensive players on the team, just given the style with which he creates. And so, you know, it's hard to say. I see him as a positive piece on this team right now and critical to the 2018-19 Timberwolves. But going forward, you need to, if you're going to keep Derrick Rose, you need to decide that your identity for at least the next couple years is Derrick Rose-centric. And I don't think we know that is for sure a good idea.
I wrote about that a little bit last night, today, whatever. You don't know how much longer Derek's going to be able to
see.
Do
that's
this.
What's going to be my thing. We don't know if he's going to be able to sustain this going into like next year and the year after that.
And this has been a great resurgence story and all that, but you don't know how long it's going to last.
Totally. And the volatility of his injuries, even this season, mm-hmm. which has been a comparatively healthy season for him, it's tough. I think the team can struggle when their in a Rose game when the identity shifts to something different, not because Rose is bad, but because the style they're playing offense with has changed. And the one thing you can point to of late is even after that Phoenix win, in the last 13 games Derrick Rose has played in, the Wolves are 3-10. Mm-hmm. And the last eight games Derrick Rose has missed, they're 6-2. I think that paints a little bit of an unfair picture to the player, but there's something there. There's something to that.
Amount of games.
Yeah,
it's not a huge sample size, but it's a fair amount of games to make you say, huh, that's interesting.
I will say, and I put this in the piece, that I think he is definitely a positive offensive piece for this team. At every juncture of the season, as I went through in the piece, the offense has been better whenever Derrick Rose is on the floor versus off. If you go to the Jimmy days, the days right afterwards, I mean, particularly so then where that second unit was clicking, whereas Rose and Covington, I mean, the offense is always better with Derrick, but you do need to weigh the opportunity cost of the defense being a lot worse. Since the Butler trade, when Derrick Rose is on the floor, I mean, in the Ryan Saunders era, the defense has been
five games,
six games,
six
but
games,
and
bad.
That Rose hasn't even played in all those. Like, the defense has given up 121 points per 100 possessions, and that's
not great.
That's about as bad as it gets. Again, that sample's smaller. The reason I think there's something to that is because even when Rose was clicking earlier in the year, the defense was also struggling there as well. So, I mean, he remains a fascinating kind of character, and one that, you know, that's hard to pinpoint. I think that the trump card for me is that he's so well liked in that locker room. Yeah. And
it's bigger than just basketball.
Yeah. And I think that's what makes him a positive on this team, is that every man in that locker room believes that Derrick Rose is a positive on that team.
Danny, you talked about money with him. It's going to depend on the money. Like, if he is brought back, if they are going to bring him back, and if he really does want to come back, what is that? What does that money look like? What does the length of the contract look like?
It's more than the veteran minimum.
Yeah,
I promise you that. He's not coming back to Minnesota next year in the same deal he's on this year. He's going to bite into that mid-level.
Was it 2.1 or something like that, the vet minimum?
Well, yeah, so he's making 2.4, but it only counts as 1.5 for the Wolves. But
sure.
I mean, that's nothingness. Bring Derrick Rose back on that if he'll come back, for sure.
Oh, yeah
definitely.
That's no question.
But it's going to be more than that.
There's going to be a ton of teams who are going to have the mid-level exception that can pay him $9 million a year. Mm-hmm. And the Wolves cannot exceed that to pay Derrick Rose. They don't have his bird rights.
They need one more year to get those.
They can't pay him more than that $9 million a year. So that becomes a question of, does he have a market value that's $10 million, $11 million, $12 million a year?
Would that eat their mid-level if they bring him back for that? Would that take their mid-level away? Or?
No, they could use their mid-level, another $9 million one, and they have what's called his early bird rights.
Okay.
So you could give that to Rose and the mid-level, but then you're in the luxury tax, mm-hmm. which opens up a
whole
other camp.
Different, yeah. Yeah.
And that's not a place you want to be when you're not a championship contender.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It doesn't
At
make
least,
sense.
Like, well, I mean, Houston this season, their owner said, we're not paying the luxury tax, and mm-hmm. Houston probably isn't going to win the championship, but they're a contender.
That's why Oklahoma City broke up.
Yeah, right?
I mean, that's why Oklahoma City didn't have Kevin Durant, James Harden, and Russell Westbrook longer than they did.
And I think there's just some confusion around that where people are like, just open up the checkbook, Glenn Taylor, and you hear that all the time, but that's not just a Glenn Taylor thing, mm-hmm. like him being cheap. Like that happens in many, many markets until the team is at a place where you say, yeah, we can get to the finals this year. That's normally kind mm-hmm. of the line we draw. And what I understand, that's the line that
And that's
Glenn
the line
Taylor's
that should be drawn. I have no issue with that. I don't have an issue with not wanting to go into the luxury tax for a team that might win 50 games. Mm-hmm. Like maybe might be a seven seed, maybe as high as four. Like, is that worth it? No.
And by then you're playing Golden State or somebody in the first round and probably getting beat.
Well, I mean, Golden State won't be as good as next year without Boogie or KD. So, like, maybe that's a favorable matchup. Draymond just keeps getting older.
It's so funny every time you have any sort of salary-related Timberwolves conversation. It all just comes back to Andrew Wiggins. And you know, we know he's not quote-unquote worth or playing at the level of a max level contract, but you know, what is it? Can he be a player that's worth $12 million, $15 million? And then
what's he worth right now?
Well, I mean, it would have been so interesting had he hit the restricted free agency market this past summer, you know, and that's what happened with Zach LaVine, right? They're the same class. They opted to give Andrew Wiggins the max a year in advance to lock him up, whereas the Bulls said, well, go test the market, Zach LaVine. We'll see what your market value is and then come back and make our decision. LaVine went out and got the biggest offer sheet he could. 4 years, $78 million from the Sacramento Kings. The Bulls said, all right, we'll sign that. So you got Zach LaVine. His market value was $78 million. We don't know what Andrew Wiggins's was, but the Wolves paid him $148.
Mm-hmm.
And I just believe that Wiggins's actual value falls somewhere between those two is what he would have received, because there are teams out there who think they could get more out of him. They could say, well, he's had all these different coaches, he hasn't been optimally used, yada yada yada. But I don't think there's a team who, if you were a free agent this summer, they say, yeah, let's roll it out and pay him.
I don't think you'd pay more than the mid-level if he were a free agent right now.
But see, that brings me to my next question, though. If Andrew Wiggins got what Zach LaVine got, how much better are you feeling about where he's at if he has the contract that Zach LaVine has versus this max contract that he has?
Well, you're feeling better because the future isn't as financially bleak. It's still tough. I mean, you still got Kat there, and the two would combine for, what would that be, $50 million rather than $65 million or something like that, or $60 million. And That would still be tough, but I mean, I don't know if you're getting $60 million of value or $50 million of value even from this Wiggins and Kat right now, just because they haven't necessarily proven to be players who bring the best out of each other. And that's like a whole nother factor of just what's happening actually on the floor between the chemistry of those two players. I mean, they're cool. Like, those guys are friends and cool in the locker room, but
on the floor, it's different.
They're games.
Yeah, they're games. Like, how well does that mesh? And I don't know. It's a crazy what if. Like, what if they would have not given him the max right then and allowed him to test?
What ifs.
Yeah, and it'll be something we look back, and when Kat's deals up, and we're like. And if we're saying it's kind of like KG, we're like, yeah, this didn't work. If that happens, knock on wood, it doesn't. But that's what you go back and you start looking at. You say, what big financial moves did you make along the way that hindered this process?
What if they didn't sign Joe Smith?
Oh boy, that would take a whole another episode to go down that path. It's
it's the Gorgie Jang contract. Mm-hmm. You know, there's been a lot of things along the way where you go, all right, this team is really in a difficult financial situation to construct a roster around their best player. It's not impossible, but it's tough.
How about G's box score the other night? Yeah. 3 minutes, 30 seconds.
Yeah. I mean,
Lu Aldeng had more on-court time than Gorgie Jang did.
We think that's a product of Phoenix actually having no centers who played in that game.
Probably,
though, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
but still, it's just not great.
Yeah. Well, that's the frustration with G, no matter what, is that, you know, you got Kat, who's playing 35 plus a night.
And deserves to be. Needs to be.
So there's only 13 minutes available, you know, in a normal game, because we haven't seen G, you know, share the floor with Kat.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, when the maximum amount of minutes available is 13 and the player's making more than that in millions per season, like, you just have a misallocation of assets in that way. And granted, when Gorgie was signed to that, he was playing power forward alongside Kat, and the market was obviously very different in 2016. You had the Joakim Noahs, Mozgovs, and everybody getting paid as much or more than Jang. But
Mozgov got $64 million.
Mozgov got 64.
And he agreed to that thing at 12:01 Eastern time.
He got it. Jan Mahimi got the same deal as Jang, too.
Matthew Dellavedova got paid by the Bucks.
Yep, 444.
Tyler Johnson got paid. He signed that offer sheet with the Nets, I believe, and then Miami matched it.
Biombo was the year before.
No, Biombo was that year.
Was that the same summer?
Biombo was 2016. He had two good games in the conference finals, and then the Orlando Magic were like, it's a good idea to sign him. No, it was not.
Yeah, no, the centers got very, very much overpaid in that market.
Everyone
because
did.
Mozgov. Yeah, but I think center was the most, well, in retrospect, the worst deals that were handed
out.
And
not year. Even like star centers, just role players.
Mozgov.
Mozgov, yeah.
Mozgov was not in the rotation for the Cavs.
He got benched in the finals, yeah.
He didn't play in the playoffs.
Well, he just doesn't play now.
Yeah.
But he doesn't play now. Neither does Joakim Noah, who got even more than him.
But prior
Biombo
to signing the extension.
Kind of plays. Yeah.
At least Biombo was young.
That's true.
Mozgov.
He was 30. Mozgov was 30.
Mozgov, and he was out of the rotation. He didn't play in the playoffs for the Cavs. Like, he just sat at the end of the bench.
Mitch Kupchak and Phil Jackson. What the hell were they thinking? What were they thinking?
Hey, but, okay, so they made some really poor decisions. And they're still not in the worst situation ever. Yeah, they're LA, so they got like LeBron. But even if they don't get LeBron, they still got some at least interesting young pieces there,
sure.
too.
So they have Josh Hart and Kyle Kuzma.
They're in a place where they could begin to build. I mean, they won 31 games last year without LeBron. And with all those guys, rookies or second year players, you know, they're able to build. So I say that because the Wolves' financial situation is bleak, but there is always the opportunity to, you know, nail moves on the margins. Every draft pick you have, it's got to be Josh Okogie or better.
Yeah.
You know, kill the mid-level exception whenever that comes up and keep nailing those moves. I mean, because you signed Wiggins and Kat to these deals,
your margin for error is
your
much
margin
smaller.
Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely, Manny. It's they gotta nail it. And the first test is this trade deadline that, what do you say, seven games? Comes up in seven games?
I do believe so. I know they play Phoenix tonight, obviously. The Lakers on Thursday, the Jazz Friday, the Jazz Sunday, the Grizzlies Wednesday, the Nuggets Saturday, and then the Grizzlies again.
Mm-hmm.
And then they play the Magic the day of the trade deadline.
And these next
three Grizzlies games are always tricky to win. They're always tricky.
Even when
the Grizzlies are bad, it's always
they
tricky,
They lost
man.
To the Anthony Davis-less New Orleans Pelicans last night by 10.
These three games for the Wolves aren't necessarily against good opponent or great opponents. Obviously, Phoenix is one of the worst teams in the league. And then you have the Lakers, who LeBron, I think, it may or may not play in that way. I don't think we know.
We don't know, yeah.
The TNT game.
Let's try and get him a go. Let's optimistically
All
say
their
he
games
doesn't.
Are nationally televised right now. They are just in the stretch of their schedule where they've got like 7 of their 10 games are on national TV and LeBron's nowhere to be found.
Wow.
The Wolves, next, they have 3 games and 4 nights, all of which are on the road. The hardest one is that Utah game, the third, and that's the third of 3 road games and a road back-to-back. So, like, you can look at that schedule you just read off, Danny, and be like, all right, this is a pretty, like, of Western Conference teams, this is about as nice as it can be.
Mm-hmm.
But the structure of the timing of the games and where the games are played, you know, put an even more of a hindrance on this team who's already being dragged down by the injuries of Tyus Jones, Robert Covington. Jeff Teague was sick last game. I mean,
questionable tonight with an ankle.
Who's questionable tonight?
Teague ankle. Is? Yeah.
Mm.
And so you got guys like Jared Bayless and Luol Deng playing actual minutes.
And you may have to, because of the injuries that you have at the point guard position, you may have to ask Derrick Rose to play more than what you normally want him to.
He's going
to
be around 35 minutes again.
And then you're running the risk of him getting injured again, man. It's just, yeah.
It is worth noting that the tiebreaker between the Wolves and Utah could be settled by Sunday, which may or may not matter down the stretch.
Probably not.
It could. I mean,
for the 10th and the 11th seed.
Yeah, you never know.
No, I think Utah's been playing great.
Utah has a very easy schedule too coming up. They've played a very tough schedule so far this year.
It's a critical juncture in the schedule, and but you're kind of, as Ryan Saunders would say, you need to be a no-excuse team at this point. And
yeah, is that going to be his thing, we think?
I don't know. Something like that. But he is so much more open.
Oh, my goodness, yes. Tibbs,
so.
It's not he's been even close.
For us, it's been a joy to, you know, get questions answered and stuff.
To talk to a human.
Oh, that's harsh.
I mean, yeah. Tibbs wasn't relatable ever.
I mean, you have more perspective than I do of having being a media member amongst many other coaches. But I will say, the only perspective I have is you're talking to the other coaches at shoot-arounds and pregame and that sort of thing.
Sure.
They are much more like Ryan Saunders.
You know who he reminded me in terms of personality was David Blatt, and that didn't go well.
Yeah, because you covered Cleveland?
Yeah. They were very similar in the way that they dealt with the media.
And Tibbs was with David Blatt?
Yes. And at least Tibbs has been around and done stuff. Like, David Blatt was a rookie head coach and was like that. It was bad.
Yeah, he didn't think he was a rookie head coach.
Oh, no, he did not. He thought his job was like being a fighter pilot.
Wow.
So many tactical decisions. And then Tyronn Lue had to save him from calling a timeout they didn't have in a playoff game.
Yeah. Did either of you guys talk to Pop on Friday?
Pop really didn't talk.
He was not.
He's not been in a mood either time. The Spurs came to town this year.
I remember it lasted 1 minute and 21 seconds, was according to my recording on my phone.
Which, you know, I don't hate because I just get to go eat quicker.
But it's normally a joy to talk to the, you know, opposing coach who, it's good to hear.
Like when Sacramento's in town? Oh, awesome.
Yeah. Well, he loves Minnesota. Yeah, but even like Alvin Gentry was here before and, to, you know, hear him talk about
when Atlanta came to town.
Yeah, it's informative. Mm-hmm. And like we can have what all these opinions of what we think the players are and this and that, but those guys are professionals who have been in the NBA for 30 years who, mm-hmm. you know, can actually say, this is what I'm seeing out of the Minnesota Timberwolves, what's working and what's not working, what they can be and what they haven't been, whatever. And you know, that's the insight that I think this fan base has lacked, honestly, is some transparency as to what's happening.
I am excited for Golden State at the end of the year when Steve Kerr talks. Steve Kerr's awesome.
Right.
He's so great.
I think once you have a little bit of perspective of being in the media yourself, and you know what?
That's true. I think that's something that we forget about with him is that, you know, he spent time working for TNT.
Well, and there's cameras everywhere now, and there's recordings everywhere now. It gets out that it's a different media landscape today that you need to be cognizant of as a coach and as a player that, you know, you're not just it used to be where the only access to what the coaches and players really had to say was what the beat writer of the paper of record recorded at the game and put in the paper the next day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now you got the people with their cameras up recording every single one and you know exactly what Tibbs said immediately. I mean, the fan base was
toughness.
uniquely aware of who and what Thibodeau was putting out because they could see it all the time.
Yep.
Whereas, you know, other coaches, I don't know, maybe I wasn't here when Rick Adelman was, but maybe Rick Adelman was a little more tight to the vest. I don't know. But there weren't things weren't getting out there in 2012 or whatever in the same way that they are in 2019. I just think what I learned in the process of the Thibodeau era is I have a more of a belief in the importance of, you know, the public relations element of being a coach. It in many ways I think alienated Thibs from this fan base. That alone, not just the yelling on the sidelines or the seemingly antiquated doing the same thing over and over, the tight rotations, like those things were all tough but somewhat explainable. The unwillingness to really open up to the fan base, I think that was a really big factor in his alienation.
Danny, I don't think I can retire my Tibbs voice just yet.
Fine.
I think we've got to. I got to let it go out to the end of the season at least.
As long as this studio is brand new.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah,
that's fair. That's very fair. Good call, Dan.
Find this podcast on iTunes, podcast1.com, and of course the all new ScoreNorth.com as well. Follow Danny at Real D Cunningham on Twitter. Follow Dane at Dane Moore NBA. Follow me at Manny Hill 84. Thanks for listening to Raised by Wolves. We'll have a live on the radio edition coming up this Thursday. Until then, enjoy your Wolves basketball, and we'll talk to you next time.